Welcome to The Sit Down. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is the latest addition to our Raging Chicken Radio podcast. On The Sit Down, we talk with activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble-rousers of all sorts to deepen our discussions and to prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, on Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. And subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work we do with Raging Chicken. Seriously, you click on it, you support it, you subscribe to it, that boosts us up in the ratings and then gets the word out even further. And if you want to help build a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, well, you can become a member for as little as $2 a month. $2 a month, folks. That's less than the cost of beer or a cup of coffee. $2 a month. We even lowered it. It used to be $5. Now we're at $2 a month. You can become a member of Raging Chicken Press. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. Seriously, we've got some cool stuff there. Some t-shirts, a book, and a sticker even. You know, it's all fun stuff, right? So check it out. You can even come on this podcast, right? Seriously, this podcast right now you can be on. So come on aboard. So today on The Sit Down, I'm totally psyched that we're talking with Marlena Eck. She is the founder and editor of Lehigh Valley Vanguard and co-founder of Rag Queen Periodical. Lehigh Valley Vanguard resides at the intersection of art and politics. The Vanguard features narratives which speculate on late capitalism, the efficacy of mainstream politics, explorations of identity, and the fetishization of market relationships and neoliberalism. You can check out everything over there at www.lehighvalleyvanguard.org. And Rag Queen Periodical. She is co-founded with Kaylee Tedesco. This features writing about the embodiment of womanhood, regardless of how that's manifested in one's life. Rag Queen deviates from neoliberal corporate feminism, focusing instead on subverting the erasure of female agency and identity. Nuance, intersectionality, and evocative storytelling are Rag Queen's signposts. You can check out all her work over at Rag Queen at www.ragqueenperiodical.com. Marlena is also the president of the board and founding member, along with Rick Smith and yours truly, of the Citizen Media Center. Marlena has published extensively on issues of class, labor, and feminism, marginalization, and precarity. A small sampling of her publications include The Responsibility of D-Class A Intellectuals in The D-Class A Intellectual, Jesus Can't Save Us from Capitalist Patriarchy, a memoir in Rag Queen Periodical, How to Be an Adjunct and a Cliché, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Decolonizing Writing and Critical Participation, A Year of Publishing on the Margins in Hybrid Pedagogy, and Property Over People, or What Can We Learn from Baltimore, published right here, Raging Chicken Press. Marlena holds a master's degree in English Language and Literature from Kutztown University and a master's in Globalization and Educational Change from Lehigh University. And she's currently enrolled in the PhD program in Literature and Criticism at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Oh my God, it goes on forever. But I'll tell you, it's because, and I didn't even scratch the surface on how amazing Marlena Eck is. And Marlena, you know, I'm a fan, and I'm so happy that you're going to decide to join us on the podcast today. Welcome to The Sit Down.
Thank you for having me. I hope that I can be as gracious with your questions as you were when I was a graduate student, constantly coming up to your office at random times, talking to you about all avenues of my life and my indecisiveness when thinking about what I should do next. Being a radical, you know, it's hard for us radicals out there in the struggle. So thank you. And thanks for having me on the show. And I appreciate the intro too. Us writers are used to writing our own. So when someone writes one for us, it's like, wow, cool. I'll sit back here and listen.
I know. It's like, wait, I did that? Really? This is great. No. And, you know, and Marlena was, over all the years, I mean, I have one wall in my office at campus, which is just filled with all these books that I've kind of used that have been kind of important to me over the years. And Marlena reminded me why I keep the books, right? We had a kind of little library exchange going on in my office, which was fantastic.
Yeah, Kevin Mahoney's library. I borrowed a lot of books from there.
Well, good. I hope there's going to be more. And I'm so excited, you know, that, you know, now starting in the PhD program and things like this, you know, because I just think your work is just so fantastic. And one of the reasons, you know, I especially wanted to talk to you is because, in all your work, you know, not just your, say, academic work, but the work with Lehigh Valley Vanguard, Rag Queen Periodical, you know, you've always refused basically to just get in these boxes that would somehow erase or lessen what it means to actually speak from a kind of working class perspective, and one that honors your own history and the history of the people that, you know, you kind of work so hard to fight for.
Yeah, it's very difficult to put that out there. I think it's getting better now. I mean, around the time when I was getting frustrated was like 2012. And, you know, I was putting myself out there, and I'm not the best writer in the world, but I was all right, you know. And so I was putting myself out there and generally realizing that, you know, these spaces for radical thought, radical dialogue, critical thinking were not really there. You know, it was a lot of entertainment-based magazines in my area. Mm-hmm. And there weren't many opportunities for people to kind of question you know, what was going on in their local community. There weren't many spaces for smaller scale artists to feel recognized. And, you know, I joke with a friend because obviously part of my personal philosophy is that everyone has the ability for greatness. Everyone mm-hmm. has the ability for genius. And, you know, for somebody coming from a working class background, it's a radical thing to say that, you know, anybody has that capacity, and that is how and not thinking that is how people maintain privilege, you know, thinking that, oh, there are only a few select special people that deserve to have a voice. Not everyone has great things inside of them. You know, that's how people protect privilege. So for me to start a platform for folks to contribute to was a radical act. And at the time, it's not like I thought, you know, let's start a revolution. I just thought to myself, I would like to have a platform that I believe in, that, has integrity. And I would like to open that up for other people. I think maybe you remember in the first issue, you know, I talked about the voice of the voiceless, you know, it's been said before, but those spaces need to exist. So anyway, so that was circa 2012, 2013. And I think I've seen a lot more spaces like that since then, which is encouraging.
Well, I mean, and this is one of the interesting things, and one of the aspects of the kind of work of, say, doing radical work of any sort. I'm reminded of Ian Angus's work when he's talking about radical democracy, and that it's necessary to actually have spaces to deliberate, to discuss, actually, that is not just about, you know, yes, we have free speech, so I can get up and stand on my soapbox and kind of say what I want to say, but also a way of kind of collecting and focusing the energies of, you know, a community. So, you know, when you look back in Lehigh Valley Vanguard, when you started Lehigh Valley Vanguard, I mean, it really was kind of your baby, so to speak. I mean, you know, this is the idea that, you know, it's not enough just to get, you know, your own writing out there, but having to think about how do you kind of create that community. And I think you did it a really interesting way, that you're bringing together both, you know, kind of public intellectuals, but also artists and poets and some fiction pieces in there. So how did you that all come together to say they want to bring this kind of collection of, say, radicals, or at least this kind of include these folks or these kinds of writing in the community?
I think that part was very intuitive for me. I mean, mm-hmm. I've always dabbled in each of those things, you know, as a teacher, you know, you become somewhat of a public intellectual. So there's that. And poetry, I've always dabbled in poetry and art. And I came to know a lot of artists and poets, and those people are some of the most radical people in society. It's funny, for one of my classes now, we were reading The Republic, and I don't know, you know, Plato's Republic, he argues that the poets need to be kicked out of the community, right? Because they're because they have the ability to mime, to mimic, to imitate to induce emotions. And I think poetry is one of the ways that we can mobilize activists and mobilize writers, writer activists who feel as though, you know, I can't write prose to save my life. Maybe they feel insecure about their prose. I feel like everyone should, you know, try at least, because everyone has, you know, that ability. But some people feel more comfortable with poetry, and because it's not so form, you know, it's not so, you know, it can be funny, it can be grotesque, it can be all these things in one poem, you know, and it can look beautiful. You know, it can just look great. I mean, there are some good prose out there that are beautiful and moving, but poetry is a way for people, marginalized people especially, to feel empowered, you know? So that's why the poetry was always going to be there. Thinking about getting it started too, I mean, you look at the site now, you look at Lehigh Valley Vanguard now, and you think, oh, this is a nice, this is a polished site. This is, you know, everything shows up the way it's supposed to. It looks pretty good. You would remember, and other people who were there mm-hmm. with me from day one would remember, you know, I'm a very fiery person. When I have an idea, I need to do it. I need to do it now. And I can't, like, I'm a big idea person. So I started the site, and I sent it to my good buddy, Matt Wolf. And I was like, look at the site. I started it. It's great. You know? And he's like, okay, super.
It's like, okay, yes, it's good.
You spelled blog with two G's. You know, I can't access this part of the site, you know, it's just like, okay, you know, details. But, you know, it started out and it was very lo-fi looking, and I just did it to have it. But, you know, even though there were some issues, the cool thing about radical communities, the cool thing about arts communities is that people like that are usually big picture people, and they know that they're not pedantic. You know, they know that good things have glitches. They take time, you know, and they get on board with the ethos, you know, you don't need to like corral them. They're like, yeah, I'm on board, you know, cause they're, I would love to be able to articulate how radical these people are, you know, that they're not, you know, they're not by the book people. So anyway, so it was very easy for me to attract all those people and say like, you know, get on board with this project, even though there are several typos on the site and, you know, it doesn't look very good right now. They're like, I love this. You're talking about what we need to have a discussion about. And my good friend Phyla Back says, you know, Lehigh Valley Vanguard is a dialectic conversation. You know, it's a dialectic where people are coming together and they're talking these things out. It's not propaganda, you know, it's not neoliberal propaganda, which is what is in a lot of these entertainment magazines. It's a place where people are talking about what is happening to them in real life. You know, they're revealing things about themselves, about the conditions they face. And it's something that we really needed in our community. And I'm glad that, you know, it provided a platform for people. Really glad.
Yeah. And I'm really, you know, I was reminded of a couple things as you were talking about this. I was reminding of two things. One, I just happened to this past weekend, I was reading some stuff about the muckrakers, right? You know, the early muckrakers, late 1800s, early 20th century. And one of the things that just really echoed with what you're doing there at Lehigh Valley Vanguard, right, is that places like McClure's, right? McClure's, who, you know, was like the site for muckraking journalism back in the day, did exactly what you're talking about with Lehigh Valley Vanguard, included poetry, included fiction, right? And included kind of cultural stories as well as hard-hitting investigative news stuff. So it was this space that actually collected and help focus, right, attention on a kind of much more radical perspective, much more inclusive perspective about American kind of society and culture. And by inclusive, I mean, you know, people kind of from the working class, right, from working classes or kind of, you know, the D class A middle class, right, could see themselves and the possibilities that were here, that it wasn't just the robber barons that were going to be able to kind of define this. And it echoed a lot into where we are today. And then on the other hand, I'm also thinking about Miles Horton, who, you know, founded the Highlander School of Social Research in Tennessee, is that one of the things that he did when, and not just him, but, you know, everyone who was associated with Highlander, and it's still around, you know, his book was called like The Long Haul. Right. And he talked about this perspective about, you know, this is not, you know, we're not training people in how to kind of do nonviolent protest or collective organizing or direct action so that, you know, we could accomplish this goal right tomorrow. But this is, we're in it for the long haul and it takes time. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about that same process because I've gone through the same thing with Raging Chicken Press and a variety of other projects where you say, okay, look, you know, it's a cliche, but you could say that the perfect can often be the enemy of the good, right? Of the enemy of that thing, of even being able to start a project like Lehigh Valley Vanguard. And sometimes those, you know, you've got, you know, we've talked about this multiple times before, those pedantic people out there, the, you know, the grammar trolls, right? Who can utilize and, you know, and I always see it about a function of certain privilege, right, to mobilize shame around official, you know, conventions or whatever we're talking about in order to try to say that what you're doing is not good enough. But it seems like any social movement, right, or any kind of like expression of, say, working class interest is going to go through that process of kind of becoming. Right. And that's what I love about what you've been doing.
Yeah. So let me respond to a few things there. So I think the biggest motivation for the Vanguard is so that we could all situate ourselves in reality, number one, because when we're reading all these, when we're looking at the spectacle, I'll just say that it's easy to not be situated in reality. And you know, for instance, the presidential election right now, I feel as though because of all these great online publications like Truth Out, like The Jacobin, like New Inquiry, you know, tangentially, but a bunch of these online publications, Raging Chicken Press, you know, is the local space to go to talk about and think about actual, you know, on the ground politics. You and Sean do a great job with that. Mm-hmm. So people can situate themselves in reality because there's been an attack on our media, you know, on our higher education systems to make us not understand where we actually are as working class people and how far we've gotten from, you know, having agency in our government, you know, just in our world in general. And so somebody brought something up to me yesterday, and maybe I'll touch on that in a little bit. But what I really want to get to is that the Vanguard has evolved, I think, and it may have always been here, but it's evolved into more of a Marcusean, you know, the one-dimensional man by Marcuse is a text that deals with Marxism in the present. It's like a post-Marxist text. So the Vanguard is like a step beyond Marxist because I believe with this project, I've shown that not only, you know, do we have to have class consciousness and, you know, like fight for the proletariat, right? But we're not just the proletariat. We're all beautiful people with something to say, something to contribute, with creativity, with promise. And we're not just workers for somebody else, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was the idea with the one-dimensional man, is to explore how did we become like this? How do we become people that wake up every day to go to work for someone else? How do we become this machinery, you know? And so Marx understood the machinery that, you know, he understood us becoming machines, but he didn't go a step further and say, okay, but what are we really? We're all individuals with promise. So I think that's another intention of the Vanguard. And that's why art is so heavy in it or has been. I've been slacking a little with art. But, you know, when you're the only one writing art reviews, I mean, if you want to do good ones, you know, you pause a little bit. But yeah, so that's a big part of it. And so since we are going to talk about the Citizen Media Center and building infrastructure for these projects, I think we should talk about these pedants or these people who want to talk about the logistics behind paying writers and paying editors for their work. So yesterday on Twitter, I reached out to just put my feelers out. I'm starting a new project, a new literary project, and I'll reveal more details as it unfolds. But
dum dum dum.
But you know, I just put my feelers out to see if anyone wanted to be involved. It's going to be a more nationally based project, which I'm excited about. But you know, I said if you're interested, you know, hit me up. And so I got a tweet from a follower of mine, and he was like, if you are going to be paying the writers, I'm intrigued. And, you know, mm-hmm. it stung a little bit to me, and I'm sure you probably didn't mean it that way. But, you know, when you're running a platform and you're unable to pay writers, although you would love to pay them for their work, you know, it doesn't feel good that you can't pay writers, especially when you have a class basis, you know, you have class critique all over your publication, you know, exactly. you can't just be okay with not being able to pay your writers. And I was telling you before the show, you know, Will Wheaton, the guy mm-hmm. from which sci-fi show did we determine he was from?
Star Trek Next Generation.
He was from Star Trek Next Gen. Okay.
Spoken yes. like the true Trekkie that I am.
Because I was thinking, is he in like some other Star Trek-ish show? And I'm going to get this wrong and all the Trekkies are going to like kill me. But anyway, so Will Wheaton, he wanted to write an article for Huffington Post. Or no, they solicited him. They said, can we repost your article on Huffington Post? He's like, great. How much do I get paid for this? And they said, nothing. We're Huffington Post. You're going to do it for notoriety. And he's like, I was on Star Trek. So I don't need that. I would like to get paid, please. And they said no. And so he wrote this diatribe about, you know, how writers need to get paid. And, like, I'm totally on board with you, Will Wheaton. And Huffington Post should be paying their writers. They make a shit ton of money, right, from their advertising and whatnot. But think for a moment about people like me and you that are running these small platforms. We don't get paid. We do it kind of as a hobby. Think about if we didn't exist, you know, think about, and some people will be like, I'm glad if you didn't exist, why don't you just go in a hole and die? but you know,
which is there out there in troll world, right?
But for those who like the projects, you know, who like Raging Chicken Press, who like to read it, like to read Lehigh Valley Vanguard, you know, following on social media, whatever, imagine if it didn't exist. Okay. And, imagine if, you know, Jacobin didn't exist before this presidential election, where we've garnered so much support for someone great for the working class like Bernie Sanders. I can't think that we would be where we were at with Bernie Sanders if the Jacobin was not founded in, I want to say, 2010. You know, so if you think about that and think about how, you know, these things don't start out with capital, especially if they're being created by a member of the working class, you need to check yourself a little bit and say, oh, okay, let me think logistically here. Where is this funding stream coming from that right. I'm thinking that I'm going to get paid for? So there are some people, some contributors I have, they write on their blog and they cross post on the mm-hmm. Vanguard, and it's true, they do get more notoriety, and that feels good because they feel as though they're being heard. So that is not to negate that we should be coming up with ways to figure out these funding streams, and we are trying to build an infrastructure with Citizen Media Center, but people really need to, like, check themselves and understand that I'm not being funded by Rupert Murdoch, and I don't have, you know, deep pockets that I can just make it rain, as you like to say, on you know, on these writers. But well, I would love to.
Yeah. Now here's, well, exactly. Now, you know, to add into this, I mean, you know, right now it's like, and with Raging Chicken is that we're actually pushing right now. I mean, we're coming up on 5 years. We started in 2011, and this July it will be our five year anniversary. And, you know, it's a, you know, for whatever it's worth, I mean, it's a good opportunity to take stock and look kind of forward for kind of what's that next set of years that's kind of coming forward. And the idea about, say, paying writers and paying contributors are actually kind of making this kind of like fund itself, these projects fund itself, is something that is really, really front and center for me right now. Because I agree, if we had to start with by being able to kind of pay everybody, pay myself even for that matter, for the work for Raging Chicken Press, Raging Chicken Press would not exist, right? But now, as you say, okay, we're establishing, we've kind of established ourselves, we're kind of moving forward. Lehigh Valley Vanguard has kind of been around now for a while. The question is, if we want these projects to be sustainable for the long haul, right, we have to think about, well, how do we make them sustainable, especially in a context, in my view, right, when investigative journalism, journalism writ large, is under assault, right? I mean, the fact that the funding streams have dried up in traditional outlets for journalism, and if we actually want to support our movements, right, then we need to have our own, like our own media networks. And what bothers me more than anything is that on the one hand, yeah, I get it. It's like, look, like I wish I could pay, and like, you know, we help fund people's, we cover people's travel costs. We've got to that point where we could fund some travel costs. We can buy some equipment for some of our contributors and things like this, but that's very limited. We want to get to that point where we're going to say, no, we want to pay people per article, and that's our goal now. So, but the thing is, it's not just about on the writing end, it's also about the progressive community writ large. I mean, we have this weird thing that goes on in kind of the progressive liberal left, right? Is that to say that on the one hand, we want kind of change, we want radical stuff. And I know I'm using a huge blanket we here, but that we want these things to happen. But when it comes down to actually making kind of like putting our money where the mouth is, so to speak, right, to get crass about it, you know, the folks doing this work, like you or like me, we can't self-fund all this stuff, right? If the progressive community wants these kind of outlets, we need to actually invest in them. And like, I know that we're not the ones who are going to put up hundreds of thousands of dollars or tens of thousands or even thousands of dollars. But, you know, you do have these kind of like legacy liberals out there, these progressives that are out there that may not be doing this work, but they have the money and they can make it rain, as we're saying on NPR, right? You know, in their local NPR station. Sure, I'll donate this. I'll get my NPR coffee bag and I'll feel as a good citizen, right? But we need to kind of start shifting our perspective, especially those of the progressive or left end of things, and say we need to start investing in our own infrastructure. The people are going to tell the stories, right, from the perspective of struggle. And, you know, that really has to be, I think, a long-term goal of the movement. Again, this goes back to what's the long haul, because the more, if we keep on going from, you know, moment to moment, is that we're going to burn out. As you know, I mean, we've talked about this too as well, is that there's only so much you can take on your own shoulders until you just got to, like, I got to stop, right? I got to take a break. I cannot take on one more thing, or something is gonna crack.
Yeah, and there's a huge sense of guilt there, you know, saying like, okay, well, you know, you write this article, I can't do it all on my own, and it's like, okay, but they're not getting paid either. You know, they're taking time out of their day, out of their work schedule, because, you know, in working class, we all need to eat. And yeah, I mean, it's a lot to deal with. And then you also have the, as we were mentioning before, the pedants that like to troll and say, you know, not realizing that you don't get paid for any of this work or research. This guy said to me yesterday, after doing some strange nighttime recon work on all of my Google Plus posts, he said, "I know proofreading is a drag, but you might want to check this sentence here and revise it." And I'm just thinking to myself, listen, buddy, you know, the article that you're referring to, it has over, you know, I don't know, 5 weeks of, you know, hours of research and revision. And you're going to, can I let anything fly here?
Yep.
All right. If you're going to fuck with me over one sentence, I mean, get a life, you know? And at the same time, that's kind of your audience. It's kind of, you know, people who maybe had bad experiences learning to write by jerky, pedantic teachers who mm-hmm. didn't understand the meaning of writing, or maybe didn't receive training in composition or rhetoric like yourself, and understand that composition and rhetoric is for more than just, you know, polished products, right? But that is kind of another function of class, right? You gotta have this polished product. It doesn't matter about the message or, you know, the punch behind it. So anyway, yeah, and that's always been a thing, but luckily, no,
And I tell you, my standardized, you know, kind of comeback, especially when it comes on email, I don't do this kind of like on people make those comments on, say, like Facebook or kind of in public comments. I don't do this publicly, but especially comes to my email. I always send it back to them. It's like, you know, it's funny. I didn't see you on the membership rolls. know, it's like, you want an editor? I'd be happy to hire one. So how much are you putting up, you know? And again, it's like, and I tell you, it took me a long time to get to that point, which I'm willing to make it, you know, that crass of an appeal, right? Because, you know, there's also, I think, in doing this kind of work, right, you recognize that a lot of people out there that are kind of, who are activists and are fighting this stuff don't have a lot of money to as well, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. So, you know, kind of, you don't want to. It's like, but then you look at it, it's like, well, I'm also, I didn't sign up to, you know, be in the priesthood, right? And, you know, this is the same thing they want to do to education, like an education all the time. It's like, you know, teachers are supposed to do it because just they love it, right? And you're not supposed to like to get paid or like to eat or pay your rent or anything like that, right? So, you know, I think about that as kind of saying, look, I'm with you. You want an editor? If that is kind of a high priority here, then guess what? We got to put up for it because it's got to come out of somebody's pocket and it could be a little bit from all of us, right? Or it's going to have to, you know, one big, you know, the ideal progressive donor in the sky is going to have to come down and kind of, you know, make it rain.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny, that argument is so funny because it's like, yeah, we are doing it because we love it. We have always been doing it
exactly
for that reason. But we need to like kind of, you know, try to plan for the future. And we also, you know, if it doesn't turn out, like we're probably still going to do it because we love it. I mean, let's be honest, you know.
No, absolutely. Right. And the thing, it's like, you know, you get to that point. It's like, well, how long can I keep this going? Right. And how long can I do this in a way that it's not negatively or like detrimenting my own health or my own, you know, well-being, you know, because, you know, we have our lives are bigger than just these publications that we're trying to put together. Right. And if we're actually serious about bringing forth kind of radical fundamental change, right, then that needs to be part of it. You know, I've never been a believer until, you know, we wait till after the revolution before we actually start taking care of each other. We need to do that all throughout that process. And part of it's about, you know, supporting and nurturing those very, you know, institutions that are growing up. Well, listen, we're coming right up to a break. We went long on segment number one. It was because I just love talking to Marlena and she's got so much to say and this is a great conversation. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders. I mean, this is being recorded the day before the last big primary day. So this is June 6th when we're recording this. Marlena came out early back in February, I believe, on the Lehigh Valley Vanguard in support of Bernie Sanders and laid out a case for why kind of she's going to vote for Bernie Sanders and why Bernie Sanders actually got her wanting to vote to begin with. Right. And so we're looking at this now. This is several months later and we're coming up with this big primary. The Democratic convention is coming up in Philadelphia. So we have this kind of cool opportunity to say, well, what is it about Bernie Sanders that seems to have gelled with so many people? But we're going to get to that right after this break. This is the Sit Down, the Raging Chicken Radio. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back with Marlena Egg.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. During that summer, the battle waged over the efforts to unionize the southwestern West Virginia coal mines. The miners had been evicted from their company homes and had established tent colonies. One was located at Lick Creek. On this fateful day, state police and company gun thugs raided the Lick Creek camp. The police claimed that members of the tent colony had been shooting at strikebreakers. They arrested 56 men and destroyed the tents and furniture in the camp. One striker was shot down and killed. Later that summer, at their convention in Matewan, West Virginia, the delegates of the United Mine Workers of America adopted a resolution condemning the action. The attack on the tent colony was included in a list of grievances against the mine owners. It described the attack as one of the most brutal murders ever committed in the history of our state by the state police and deputies. Composed of the Baldwin-Felts detectives was the attack on the Lick Creek tent colony on June 14, 1921, in which our brother, Alex Breadlove, willfully murdered by the state police while his hands were uplifted and begging for God to have mercy on his soul. The resolution went on to condemn the atrocities against the miners and demand the federal government and governor of West Virginia to restore law to the local police forces. The resolution was sent to the President of the United States, West Virginia's Governor Morgan, and the officials of the American Federation of Labor. It was also sent to Labor and other newspapers.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Sit down. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm here today on the sit down with Marlena Eck. She is the founder of the Lehigh Valley Vanguard and the co-founder of Rag Queen Periodical. Marlena, I wanted to talk a little bit about, tomorrow, right? I mean, we're recording this today, as I said before. Tomorrow is kind of big primary day. And when this airs, there'll be more kind of talking head discussion about what's gone on in the Democratic Party and so on. But, you came out relatively early, I think, in this process and support of Bernie Sanders. And on Rag Queen, on Lehigh Valley Vanguard, you published this piece, Why I Will Vote and Why I Will Vote for Bernie Sanders. And this was back in February. And I want to read for people just a little bit about your intro there. And I think you can walk us through a little bit about what seemed to be kind of the motivating factor, or what seems to be from your angle, the motivating factor, but why so many people are getting behind Bernie Sanders and what this might speak to for a kind of bigger movement. So this is from the beginning of that article. So it's quote, like many millennials, I've never voted. Most of my friends and acquaintances know this about me. Some understand it, others condemn it. At the deepest level, I identify as an anarcho-syndicalist. Our ability to choose where we stand in individual situations makes us human beings. So while in the past I did not identify with any liberal, neoliberal, handpicked Democratic nominees, which I will discuss briefly, Bernie Sanders is different entirely. Sanders also helped show us what our system has become. Contrasting him with Hillary Clinton, a candidate who is really a moderate Republican, Sanders is a person who has always been an independent with the interest of underrepresented groups. Hillary Clinton is the liberal choice because she is a woman. Political and in some ways moral efficacy is a whole other situation. She will not bring us to a place that is more hospitable for the poor, less imperialist, and sovereign. Neoliberal feminism does not help subvert capitalist oppression, which should be our main goal. Clinton will do whatever corporations want to this country. That's not advantageous for regular people. We already know that. Now, go ahead.
I was going to say, let me unpack this idea of Hillary Clinton. While I really don't want Donald Trump to win, although I kind of feel if Bernie gets kicked out, I'm a little scared. But let's not go there yet. We'll see. Hillary Clinton supporters, you can see in her supporters the attitude that these kind of neoliberal Democrats or neocons have towards working class people. I remember seeing a tweet, just kind of like perusing around Twitter and seeing a tweet by someone on Twitter that said, ha ha, you dumb Bernie supporters, you forgot to register to vote, so Hillary won. It's like so out of touch with what working class people have to go through. First of all, many of them don't feel as though they're represented in politics at all. So yes, a lot of them haven't registered to vote. It's not on their radar. And even though we have tons of Bernie volunteers, who are amazing, by the way, telling people, hey, look, this is the deadline, register to vote. This is the deadline. Guess what? They're fucking working and they don't have time. And they also don't see that politicians are making any changes in their actual real daily lives. So yeah, for you and your neocon bullshit, maybe this is just like run of the mill for you. Every year I register to vote, and this year I'm voting for Hillary Clinton because she is the handpicked nominee. And so, I got to have my fake democracy, and I got to look down on poor people and, act like I'm some liberal spokesperson or I'm progressive or whatever the hell. you know, I mean, you just look at Hillary Clinton supporters and you can see the ethos of what the Democratic Party has become. You look at Bernie supporters, you look at what Bernie really wants to do for America, and no, he doesn't have everything 100% right. And yes, there are people behind him helping him. I'm sure he's also had many mentors along the way who've set him straight and shown him, you know, what is equitable for America. But guess what? Bernie listened along the way. He was a huge advocate for social justice his whole life. You know, in my article, I have a picture of him getting arrested. Many people have seen him, you know, in this picture now in Chicago, right? Getting arrested.
Yeah, here's the picture right here. You can see that right from the article. Yep.
Yeah, it's just beautiful, you know. I don't see that type of agenda with Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump may very well become our president because he is the neoliberal candidate, right? So he's a businessman, first of all. Like, how the hell has it gotten to this point when a businessman is going to win the presidential election? I mean, yes, sure. Anybody should be able to run for the U.S. presidency. Okay, I understand, like, that's kind of our thing. But the fact that, like, an actual, like, cutthroat, all his life, privileged businessman, bigot, with a fucking TV show where he fires people, could win the presidency because, you know, white people, hickish white people, are going to identify with him the most, it's just outrageous. Like, I can't believe that we've gotten to that point. However, I can go back to, like, you know, the community that I grew up in, and I could totally see how some of them would be like, yeah, I want Donald Trump to win because I saw him on TV, you know? I mean, I watched his TV show, and I think he's great, you know? So,
well, also, we're talking about, you know, we've been, you know, trained now for a generation, you know, through things like reality television and through, you know, our media in general, is that, you know, we take pleasure in, you know, stepping on the one below us, right? Is that, you know, way back in the day when Jerry Springer was first launching his shows, right? And, you know, that was the, you know, people were like, couldn't believe that this was on TV. And then a lot of the discussion around it was like, you know, it's like, yeah, that's what makes it appealing, is because people can look at that show and say, you know what, at least I'm not as bad as that. Right. And now we have an entire industry which has been going on for a generation that that kind of wants us to take pleasure, right, in someone else's misfortune or demise, as long as it's not us. Right. And as long as we don't see ourselves in it. And Donald Trump seems to me, because you think about it, right, when you have working class folks, right, who are cheering on the guy who says you're fired. Right. You know, that
and
says
meanwhile,
that,
like, they're internalizing so much hurt and pain from probably being told you're fired by a dickish boss, just like Donald Trump.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And I think that's, you know, that comes, you know, it makes a whole lot of sense to me because, you know, I look at my Facebook feed and, you know, there's just folks that I grew up with, right, who are Donald Trump supporters and so on. And I could totally see why they're Donald Trump supporters. Right. It's going to hurt them tremendously in the long run if that guy wins the presidency. It's going to further depress the economy in upstate New York, where I'm from. It's going to, you know, it's going to divert them away from really what's the cause of this mass exploitation they're experiencing. They'll all rally around the immigrants. You know, they've got to keep the immigrants out, you know, the illegals, all that kind of garbage. While meanwhile, it's, you know, the people like Donald Trump that are sending us all down the toilet.
And you know, poor people are also going to feel that immigration policy the hardest, because guess what? When you have borders, when you put up borders, those borders need to be protected. And guess who protects borders? Mm-hmm. Poor people who are seen as disposable. So, you know, if they really want that, if they really want to be, you know, racially binary, you know, obtuse, then guess what? They're going to be the ones that are dying for borders. And it's sad. It is really sad.
No, and that's you know, that's the story in so many ways. So let me ask you this. So on the other hand, right, you know, there's a ton of energy around the Bernie Sanders campaign, right? You know, if you've got this kind of right wing niche, right, and we should be clear, right, the people who are coming out and supporting Donald Trump in droves, right, are a small minority of the overall electorate that are voting in Republican primaries, right? That doesn't mean there's not more of them out there, right? But that's important to recognize. But we have huge support coming out for Bernie Sanders. And again, it's mixed in terms of like how familiar everybody is with the official rules of political participation. But that doesn't take away from, even if there's people, say, for example, that did not register to vote, that did not vote for Bernie Sanders in a primary because whatever reason, whether they're, you know, they can't stand official politics, whether they just missed a deadline, they thought they didn't understand the process, whatever that might be. You can't deny the fact that he's brought a huge amount of energy and excitement, especially among kind of for younger folks. And you can see this in the breakdown of primary voters. If you look at, you know, from 40 under, right, it's like, you know, 70 to 80% of the support goes to Bernie Sanders. But when you get to the older voters, again, who are more experienced in the mechanisms of the official politics, they tend to go towards Hillary. But here's an old white guy. Right. This is this old white guy. You know, it seems to baffle the political establishment. But what is it about this old curmudgeon-y old white guy, right, that is energizing people so much? I mean, how do you respond to those folks?
Well, I believe I cited my Twitter buddy, Bill Pletcher, in his article on the Jacobin, mm-hmm. When he talks about how Bernie is not just a dude. You know, he's a leader of a movement. He's a leader of a political movement. And a bunch of my friends, you know, public intellectual buddies have said the same thing. And they've also said, you know, I realize, you know, Bernie is losing in some of these crucial states, but guess what? He's setting up the party to be something better than just this neocon Democratic Party that we see now. He's setting up the party to be more ethical, to be more of what we want as radicals, as people who are seeing that the biggest problems in our country are, you know, privatization, debt for each American, you know, the shame of that debt, the inability for them to get health care, you know, the fear of the still fear of socialism and, you know, introducing more socialist policies to benefit the poor and working class. So, you know, Bernie sees all these things. Bernie is tapped into it. But there's a sincerity about Bernie that we all really love and that we all want to see in our politicians coming up now. And the cool thing that I love about Bernie Sanders is him running has inspired so many of my friends who have big followings to say to themselves, you know what, maybe I'm going to run for mayor, or maybe I'm going to, you know, talk to my friend that is more in a position to do that and say, hey, buddy, why don't you run for like Senate, or why don't you do this or that, you know? And that is one of the big contributions that Bernie has made, despite the fact that maybe he won't become the president, which I'm, you know, finally kind of admitting to myself, although I'm sad about it, you know, and I kind of almost went there when he lost Pennsylvania, which I was very sad about. But, you know, post Bernie, we have to think, what are we going to do? And, you know, I've cited direct action as a place we can go in radical politics. You know, I always say, you know, I understand. Kevin, you're a Gen Xer, no? Mm-hmm. Gen Xer,
yes, you
right?
Got it.
And you know, Gen
We're
Xers see
about everything.
Gen Xers are very closely tied to this idea of progressivism, right? So progressivism, though, has led us in my generation, millennials, to get into radical politics, which I feel like we want to see more potency. But progressivism, I think, is still just like clinging onto this idea that the system, it's going to change. Like it can still, they're still like so idealistic about the system, and radical politics says, you know, we're not as idealistic as you guys. We don't care about sustainability. We care about upheaval. We want this system to completely change because it's not serving anybody that we know, you know, and that's at least in like poor and working communities.
No, here's what's interesting to me is like, especially when we talk about the generational stuff, right? This is kind of an aside, but I think it's an interesting one, is that when we were Gen Xers coming up, right? You know, we were Gen Xers coming up. We were the ones who had checked out. We were the ones who had no hope. We were the ones who were cynical and just wanted to destroy stuff. That was our bag. It's only in the aftermath that people start looking at, you know, at this kind of stuff. And it's interesting, this whole word about progressivism, I go back and forth on this all the time, right? And one of the things about, you know, because the people that I came up with, you know, we were, you know, punk rock, DIYers, all this kind of stuff. And we used the word radical too as well. The question was, the difficulty that I always had, right, and continue to have, is that there'd be those folks who then kind of cloak themselves in an ideological mantle, and it became this weird kind of exercise in secular religion, right, where it became about ideological purity. And then the question is, like, well, what about the actual movement building?
Yeah, what
about
what are we going to do? Yeah, I totally
exactly
understand.
And so what was, when progressivism came up with you know, it really, for me, the way I even use that term right now, in the early 2000s, when you had the launch of the blogosphere and all this kind of stuff, progressivism kind of came back as this umbrella term to get away from liberal, because liberal had been so tainted, not by the right, but from the left, looking at these liberals who had sold out, right, any kind of quote-unquote progressive reform, right, any kind of, like, you know, working class politics, they had completely sold it out, and people were looking for a catch-all term to get away from that association with these kind of, as you say, these kind of neoliberal Democrats. And so it's always been this interesting thing for me, because if you look at the history of progressivism, I agree with you 100%, right, this idea about constant progress and all this other kind of stuff, but I also look at, you know, and as you know very well, part of my location within kind of labor movements, right, is about looking at the radical labor movements, not the official politics labor movements, but what labor always did, they did collectively when they were most powerful and they actually brought the reforms to the working class, is when they said, you know what, this is not about getting just my particular reform through or something like this. This is about doing it for ourselves together, right? It's about organizing together and building our own structures, right? And by structures, I don't mean, like, you know, buildings and this kind of stuff, but those models of a different vision of how we go about moving things forward. And, you know, so I think that's kind of important, because it's also the way that I think that this, again, official media tries to pit one generation against the next, right? Because they were doing the same thing to us, right? With the previous generation, with the boomer, I don't know if it was the boomers that came before me, I don't know who that was.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, yes, we're more radical than you guys are, but it's because we still are very hopeful. Maybe you guys are like, all right, well, what can we could just tweak things a little bit. I mean,
nah, you know, we're all like, just burn it down.
I'm getting older now, and maybe we could just tweak things. But you know, I mean, they want to destroy the energy that we obviously have. But you're right. I mean, we are looking, millennials, I think now, you know, I think about, and people, he's a controversial figure now, but, you know, that comes with the territory. But D. Ray McKesson, you know, he's running for mayor of Baltimore.
Yep.
So, you know, that is just one example. You know, John Fetterman for Senate, he was another hopeful candidate.
I almost wore my shirt today. Yep.
Yeah, he was a good candidate. You know, I'd like to see more, you know, women, you know, in the mix, as long as they have radical politics, you know, not like Hillary, not like a Hillary woman, but I would like to see, you know, like a lot of women doing it. And then, you know, people would turn on me, well, what about you? Why don't you run for the mayor? You know, and I don't know, I'm not sure, but... But, you know, it's cool that we are thinking about that. We're thinking about infiltrating, and hopefully it doesn't become a thing where you infiltrate and then you become de-radicalized, because, you know, that's kind of not what we're doing it for.
No, absolutely. And it's like, you know, I mean, again, I think that this election shows, you know, and they say right now, I mean, your generation, right? This is the biggest generation since the baby boomers, has more radical politics than any generation of recent late, and are kind of, I think, finally kind of starting to kind of put those, are seeing actually some, not even to plant the seeds, but actually beginning to see some of the shoots from the seeds that have been planted over the past several years. And we could go back to those organizing, and this is amazing. Well, listen, we're coming right up to a close, to kind of the closing end, but do you have any kind of closing thoughts? And you're about to say something, I'm sorry to cut you off, but.
So I'll end with this. Millennials grew up with Reaganism, right? And I grew up in a household where my mom was so super hardworking and too proud to accept something like welfare when we struggled because, you know, people just pushed that socialism is bad and you need to do things for yourself and all this fucking neoliberal bullshit. And so we all grew up with that, you know, not everyone lived with a single mom like me, but we all grew up hearing all that Reaganite bullshit. And so millennials are onto something. Millennials are going to be great. And we've already found avenues to do those great things. So stop writing these fucking articles about millennials, people.
Oh, man. What a way to end it on. And I agree 100%. You know, if you just pay attention, you pay half attention to the amazing organizing, the amazing activism that is going on today from kind of from young folks, you know, and I use young broadly there, right? You know, I'm going on like 45, 40. I don't even know how old I am now. But, you know, that's really... we need to be start supporting the kind of new breed of radicals that are out there. So listen, Marlena, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on a sit down this week. I definitely got to have you back kind of later on in the summer. We're going to maybe do some updates on some of the radicalization that is going to happen around the Democratic Convention that is coming up. And of course, Raging Chicken Press will be there. We look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And this is a great show. I'm really happy you're doing it.
Woohoo! Let's keep it going. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This has been The Sit Down. We'll be back with you next week with more. Keep an eye out and check us out on Podbean. Check us out on Twitter. You can go to RagingChickenPress.org for all our citizen journalism there. And we'll see you soon. All right. Signing off.
See ya.